This is Democracy,
a podcast about the people of the United States.
A podcast about citizenship,
about engaging with politics and the world around you.
A podcast about educating yourself on today's important issues
and how to have a voice in what happens next.
Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. This week, we are going to discuss free trade and tariffs and the contemporary debate, the current debate, about what kinds of protections, if any, the United States should be initiating through tariffs and other forms of supply chain security in a world of relatively open trade, but a world where many Americans seem to think, and particularly the president-elect, that open trade is a danger to the United States. What are tariff measures and how do they work and what should we expect if they're put into place? We are really fortunate to be joined by a longtime friend, a former student and colleague who has been at the center of these debates for a long time as a scholar, as a policymaker, and now as an entrepreneur. This is Meg Reese. She is, among other things, a PhD in international history, policy, and national security from the LBJ School. I had the good fortune of working with her. She then went on to really extraordinary work as the national security advisor to Senator Mitt Romney from 2019 to 2023. And she is now the founder and CEO of a super exciting new company that I hope everyone will look at and soon everyone will hear about. It will be the next Amazon, I'm sure. This is Solid Intel. One word, Solid Intel is her company. Meg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's really a pleasure to have you on. Zachary, of course, you have your scene-setting poem for us this week. What is the title of your poem?
On the Border.
On the Border. Let's hear it.
Down in the canyons where the river flows, one could mistake the silence for a peace. Where on the banks of dirt the tall grass grows, the softly whispering winds never cease. And stepping from the raft to solid rock, the other side is still in the same way. The difference seems to be on taking stock in old wives' tale, a line that jesters say. For down inside the canyons it is still, the shadows falling, rising with the day, the stars who blink the same on both the hills, the whistling winds who beg you still to stay. But stay you cannot. This is not the time. You must forget how much the border rhymes.
I love it, Zachary. It really makes me feel the border in some ways. What is your poem about?
My poem is about how incongruous the reality of the border of the United States, at least the part of the border in Texas that I'm familiar with, is with the kind of political rhetoric that we're seeing around the border, in particular, President-elect Trump's proposed tariffs against Mexico and Canada, and how strange it is to erect these legislative barriers between our neighboring countries, which are not just economically tied so closely, but ecologically, socially, culturally.
Yes, yeah, it does seem as if the rhetoric assumes a world of distinct, separate societies, which is not the reality. Meg, you've been involved from the very start of at least the last few administrations. You've been involved with trade policy, and Senator Romney has long been an advocate of increased trade, of free trade in many ways. Let's start there. What is the argument for free trade, the argument that I think is implied by Zachary's poem of the intersections and the connections between societies?
Yeah, free trade is really a tool to be able to integrate countries and their goods to facilitate the free flow of goods with the assumption that as there is minimized taxes and burdens on producers, manufacturers, consumers, that you're going to better integrate these trade routes and supply chains so that you can more easily facilitate the flow of goods. And the broader goal is generally that as you do so, you're actually going to strengthen the ties between these countries because they become very economically intertwined. And it really adds to a lot of other ties between the countries culturally, et cetera, and a movement of peoples as well, all tied up in these flow of goods.
And Meg, do you think the United States has benefited from the dividends of free trade, particularly in the last 20 to 30 years?
I don't think there's any question that free trade has had a positive impact on many aspects of the economy and society writ large. That being said, where problems happen, where there's manufacturing that moves out of the U.S. into countries where it's cheaper to produce goods, we also have the downsides. We have reductions in our automotive sector and manufacturing sectors that get blamed on free trade. And honestly, a lot of that would have happened regardless. So it's figuring out how do we balance the positive and negative sides of it. And then where I get interested is how do you understand the national security implications of these movements as well?
And what are some of the national security implications of, for instance, the free trade regime that we have had in place with China? I mean, I know you have been concerned about the ways the Chinese have been using trade access to steal secrets and technology. Is that correct?
It's secrets and technology. It's also, you know, kind of getting around the trade rules oftentimes or using things in a way that they weren't intended. I think that generally free trade has been a really, really net positive for the U.S. And I am very, very concerned about the potential of tariffs on our friends and allies where we want to actually increase these flows of goods. But when it comes to China, what we've seen is kind of the manipulation and a lot of the WTO rules in really, really problematic ways that undercut the flow of goods and, you know, have really taken on certain industries, things like solar. Actually, a number of different industries have the potential. China also will do things like massively subsidize their certain key industries, kind of sell goods into other countries at really reduced rates in a way that they actually take on the domestic industries, undercut them, kill those domestic industries, and then raise their rates when they stop subsidizing in such a profound way. And so you've seen the weaponization of trade by the Chinese in a really profound way over the last 15 or so years. And it really came to the forefront, actually probably starting at the Trump administration. You had a couple key industries that got hit really hard before then, but he did bring it to the forefront. That being said, he did it at the same time as attacking European trade. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing Canada, Mexico, and a whole bunch of other friendly or allied countries being threatened with massive tariffs that could really undercut our ability to continue or could actually lead us to violate our own free trade laws.
Zachary?
Why do you think people, and particularly politicians on both sides of the aisle, have grown increasingly skeptical in recent years of free trade? It's hardly a term one hears from national politicians regularly these days.
Yeah, every state pretty much has seen some version of backlash against free trade, but you get it really heavily in the Midwest and against industries that were previously really controlled by unions. And so you'll see a drop off both from the Democrat side and the Republican side. And it seems to flow alongside of other really problematic things we've seen in rural populations, for instance, or smaller cities as they start to flow outwards, or the jobs flow outwards. And so you'll see the uptick of fentanyl and other methamphetamine abuses, et cetera. And it seems to really integrate in people's minds that that free trade was the cause or the root cause of a lot of these problems. And so you're seeing backlash. You're not seeing the positive aspects of it, which were really, really big in the 90s, of people openly calling for free trade. And so you've just seen backlashes. And as the populist movements on both the right and the left grow even stronger, this ends up being the boogeyman.
And why does President-elect Trump and some of his trade advisors, why do they think tariffs will work? What is the logic of placing 25% tariffs or 50% tariffs, as he sometimes says, on Chinese goods, on Canadian goods, on Mexican goods?
So I can tell you the national security justification for the China side, because I think that there's a lot more general support that's popped up, at least for certain key industries, in Chinese imports. So when you do have tariffs are essentially a tax on American consumption. Trump used to say he'll make Mexico pay for it, or whichever country would pay for the tariffs. That's not how it works. It ends up being a tax that we pay, which makes a certain country's goods more expensive relative to the other potential imports of goods. And so it tends to be a tool of punishment when it comes to the Chinese goods. There are certain industries where I think there's general agreement that we need to have more domestic or allied production, out of concern that the Chinese would be willing to leverage our reliance on their goods in a conflict scenario, so that we would no longer be willing to support an ally or a friend like Taiwan because they are able to hold these supply chains over our heads. Now, that doesn't really make sense for Mexico or Canada, where we have both long-standing friendships with these two countries, and we have, you know, free trade rules in place that we don't want to violate. What Trump seems to be doing is using anger at these two countries and holding the threat of tariffs on them in order to get them to change laws, regulations, et cetera, especially related to immigration and potential of drug supply. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see if that leads to actual changes before he gets into office, where he'd be willing to say, well, you guys kind of followed through with XYZ, therefore I don't need to punish you. We'll see what happens.
So you think this is a negotiation tactic more than it is a fully thought out policy?
I think that is probably the most likely thing. So Trump has been very pro tariffs throughout for a very, very long time. So this seems to be a tool, or at least a threat of first resort for him. But he does seem willing to change or negotiate a bit. And you'll see, I mean, you saw different leaders will come to him and try to both personally or otherwise try to appeal to him, and things that those countries could be doing, Canada, for instance, that could get them back in the good graces to take off these threats. So I think there's a negotiation starting point. There's a threat, but what the actual repercussions will be, I don't think we know quite yet.
Right, right. We do know, as historians, of course, that we have a long history with tariffs in the United States. In fact, throughout the 19th century and the early 20th century, the United States had very high tariffs on trade, particularly after World War I, the infamous Smoot-Hawley tariff and various others made it very expensive to import products into the United States. And just as you said, Meg, we know that those tariffs raised the costs in the U.S. They protected certain domestic industry, but that was a time when many of the domestic industries that were being protected, when they didn't really rely upon goods from overseas. They weren't bringing in elements of the production process from overseas. And it still had very harmful effects. One of the causes of the Great Depression is the tariff regime that the United States has and other countries have that limit international trade and the movement of capital. All of that said, it does seem we're in a very different situation today where any American manufacturing relies upon foreign parts and products in the production process, right?
Yeah. It's actually to the so our supply chains are so internationally integrated at the moment that I have an AI supply chain company. So we use generative AI to try to understand where foreign companies, et cetera, potentially foreign adversaries end up in supply chains. And it is nearly impossible. So very few companies even know who are in their supply chains past the secondary to tertiary tiers of their supply chains, which means that you could be incredibly integrated with Chinese supply chains as a huge corporation, but you have the potential of not even knowing that those exist because they don't do or require reporting past a couple supply chains down or a couple links down. And so even understanding the full implications of some of these things gets really, really hard. You saw a move by China just a couple of days ago now where the Biden administration put sanctions on another 100 companies or Chinese companies. And China retaliated by putting full, they had export controls on some critical minerals like gallium and germanium, antimony, some types of graphite. And now they're putting full on bans against selling these to the US. And we really don't truly know how much we're integrated and how impactful some of these moves are going to be by China or the US as we're thinking through what the implications are for the supply chain, what that's going to mean for transferring to find alternative suppliers, or what it's going to mean for the consumers. We already have had really significant inflation for our generation. This is considered very significant. And they really trying to understand what the implications of big tariffs are going to be on our friends as well as on China. It could really hit the pocketbooks of a lot of Americans.
Hmm. Zachary?
I want to ask, how likely do you think the Trump tariffs are to be implemented? But more broadly, do you think the general trend in the last few years towards more protectionist trade policy on both sides of the aisle will continue? And in particular, why do you think the Republican Party, which, as I'm sure you are well experienced in, had long embraced free trade, has come to see protectionism as one of its key political platforms?
Yeah, I mean, I will just say I still think longingly about TPP, for instance, if you want to understand where I am.
That's the Trans-Pacific Trading Partnership, right?
Yeah. And that ended up being opposed by both Trump and Clinton in 2016, if I remember properly. So I will say that I anticipate that there will be pretty broad support for tariffs on certain types of Chinese goods going forward, at least for the next few years. We're using tariffs as a national security tool at this point, and really we're using a lot of other tools at our disposal, export controls and sanctions and general pressure points on DOD. to really try to move certain supply chains out of the Chinese market as much as humanly possible, because there's a lot of concern that there will be a kickoff of some conflict scenario with Taiwan, whether it's a blockade or military or whatever. And I'm not super convinced how the US would respond, but I do think it would lead to a lot of disintegration between the US and Chinese economies. And so if you have a lot of really key supply chains integrated in with China, you could have the Chinese really impacting whether or not the US is able to continue supporting or supplying key allies in the region if there was a physical conflict, or even if there was pressure on Taiwan. And so you're seeing a lot of folks in the national security community really supporting a lot of different levers against China when it comes to kind of moving out these supply chains. That being said, I don't see there being a lot of longstanding or growing support to apply tariffs to our friends, especially as we're building up the recognition that we need our friends very close to us in this China scenario, which means that we aren't going to be wanting to apply 10, 25, 50% tariffs on South Korea or Mexico as we're trying to move our supply chains into those countries. It doesn't seem logical to me.
And do you think that those countries will retaliate if tariffs are put in place? That was, of course, the reality of the early 20th century that we just discussed a few minutes ago. Do you see a trade war emerging?
I would be very concerned about the potential of that. I have one example, which wasn't trade, but it was part of this tit for tat thing. So during the last Trump administration, Trump was trying to get South Korea and Japan to pay, I want to say it was either 4 or 5 times what they were paying for basing US soldiers. And we were at the same time negotiating with the Philippines for some longstanding basing agreements. And I want to say it was Duterte ended up threatening the Trump administration with needing to pay 5 times what we had been paying on the exact terms to continue allowing America an American military in the Philippines. So I see other folks just following this model. Everyone ended up having to back down in certain ways to go forward, but I see the potential of threats being a thing. That being said, we have a lot of trade agreements in place where these are already defined. And so we could end up actually violating treaties as some of these threats happen, which is not good for anyone.
There hasn't been much discussion of those treaties. Do they matter?
They do. They continue to kind of set all of these various standards. We did pass a lot of legislation out of SFRC on the congressional role in abrogating or getting rid of treaties. And so there's a role of Congress in this, because you have to actually pass these treaties, right? And so there's not a unilateral authority of presidents to just stop following these, change all the rules and have there be no consequences. And so I would expect you'd see that there is going to be pushback, whether or not it happens publicly or if it happens behind closed doors. That closed doors is usually the better option. You can reduce friction between countries as well as various parties within the U.S. if you have these negotiations behind closed doors. So it's going to happen. Treaties still actually force things in certain ways. I'm a big fan of treaties. There was kind of this assumption during the first Trump administration that we had moved away from multilateral treaties into bilateral treaties. And that's what we kept being told, is the administration didn't want multilateral, they wanted bilateral. And we'll just see if that, what this looks like in this next term.
I was trying to figure this out, Megan. I don't understand this. I should. The president has authority to raise tariffs in certain circumstances, especially for national security reasons. But if there's an operable treaty, such as the World Trade Organization that we're a part of, that we're a treaty member of, does that not place restrictions on executive power?
Yeah, because it should be law at that point. So there are restrictions in place, and there has been pushback against, because again, you're completely right. There's national security, essentially exceptions that allow some unilateral things to happen, which is why the steel tariffs and others ended up being a huge debate in, I don't know, 2017 or so. Because there was a question, is there an actual national security imperative to putting these restrictions in place or these tariffs in place? And so you'll probably get that again, but I see that happening a lot more with our friendly countries. WTO, it's really funny. The WTO, when there have been challenges, the U.S. has come out ahead almost every time. And so it's strange to me that we don't go to it more often, because usually when we bring a case, we win. But that stopped being a thing that we cared about doing a lot a few years ago. And I don't really see it being the place of first resort. And China, you know, there are a lot of problems with China and the WTO, and being treated as a developing country. They have some special protections that I think there's general consensus on both the left and the right that they shouldn't have exceptions as, you know, this second most powerful economy in the world. And so there's a lot of concern about the ongoing role of China in that organization and whether or not it can actually be in the correct position in order to protect free trade.
I see. It's an important point to underline that you made, that many people lose sight of, that these international treaties and organizations, such as the World Trade Organization, that of course we helped to create, they have repeatedly protected our interests. For example, when the Chinese or other countries try to dump their products on our market, they actually have provided protection for us. So we shouldn't trash these organizations, correct?
Yeah. This is a longstanding soapbox of mine, is something like NATO. And, you know, there are a lot of international organizations that need reform in certain ways. But we did get to be one of the authors of a lot of different international bodies. And so we should be really good at using them, because we got to help create them. And I hope that we spend a decent amount of time trying to figure out how to participate for our best interest.
Yeah. So Meg, we always like to close by asking our distinguished guests like you to connect this history and political analysis with a forward-looking, hopeful perspective, if we can find that today. Where do you see this debate going? And more importantly, how can citizens who care about some of the benefits of free trade, or at least concerned about some of the costs and harms of tariffs and closed borders, how can we contribute to the debate? How can we make sure that these other voices are heard?
I would say that there's actually a true role for very smart citizens to get involved in some of these issues, because often when you're in a Senate office or even members of an administration, they only hear the negatives. They don't hear the positives. And so if there are examples of ways that you want to protect certain types of trade, or that the tariffs would be detrimental in XYZ way, actually making sure that your voice is heard, writing, calling, talking to people about it, so that these things are done in the smartest way possible. I really do think there are going to be tariffs on China in particular, but as this administration may end up learning that tariffs on a Mexico or a Canada would actually kill businesses, they will end up being responsive. So I think there's actually more room for folks to get involved in create positive change and prevent kind of more deleterious things from happening early on, because I think they will be at least somewhat responsive.
It's such an important point, and you know so well, having been in an important Senate office for so many years, the influence that ordinary constituents can have, right, Meg?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, yelling never works, but talking and being thoughtful really, really does. And highlighting, especially business owners, what the good and the bad is, so that folks who are making and writing the laws understand where the pain points are. It's so important. Part of the reason I started my company is because I had companies coming to us when I worked in the Senate and telling us about their supply chain issues. So I started understanding, and our legislation got better and more in depth and more thoughtful because I started understanding their pain points and even recognizing ways that government would not serve and there were private sector opportunities. And so those folks who come in and talk to staff in a really thoughtful way can really produce real change.
That's very uplifting to hear that, and provides us with some hope. Zachary, for younger people who benefit so much from free trade, from the movement of products, consumer goods that we're able to get a hold of, but also people being at a university where we have students, of course, from all around the world, and that those students enrich our universities. They bring knowledge, they bring perspectives. So we're obviously tied to this. How does this debate resonate in that context, and what role do you see young people like yourself playing in this debate about free trade?
Well, I think young people are probably more hopeful than their parents' generation about the possibilities of free trade. I think, if anything, the internet has made the boundaries, the borders that we began this discussion with, seem less and less meaningful, even as the economic pressures on politicians to move towards more protectionist trade policy seem to have increased. So I do think young people have a uniquely international perspective, not just on this issue, but on so many issues. And in that regard, I do think that this debate still has real meaning for young people. And I think with the growth of these technologies and the increasing ability of young people to travel, and the more and more young people growing up alongside immigrants from different countries and really sort of experiencing so many different cultures, I do think that the potential for a new young people's movement for free trade, for connections across the globe, is very much possible. And I would say that's probably one of the more hopeful elements of our moment.
And do you see young people getting involved politically around these issues, Zachary?
That I'm not so sure of. I think that young people's politics is still very much focused on the local and on the things that affect their lives, which I think makes sense and is probably a good thing in and of itself. But I do think there's room for a greater recognition of the impact of these trade policies on our lives. And I'm sure if we do see these tariffs implemented, that the young people whom they will probably end up hurting the most will be very loud in voicing their opinion.
Yeah, I think, and your poem certainly gestures in this direction. I think there's a knowledge young people have on the ground of how valuable open trade is, even though there must be, as Meg says, also certain restrictions, particularly upon national security stealing and threats. Nonetheless, how important open trade is, and I think this is only going to become a more and more important issue for young people as we go forward.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, Meg, please.
Zachary, one of the really important parts of free trade agreements is actually the human rights side. So we'll come to negotiations with countries where they have to, or where we end up doing mutual reforms, or one country has to do reforms to reach certain human rights standards. Is this something that you could see younger people getting behind?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I personally was not very aware of that until you mentioned it. So I think there's probably very little knowledge among young people of that impact. And I would say there's probably increasing skepticism of the ability of economic and trade connections to enforce democratic institutions and human rights protections. That's certainly present among young people. But I do think young people still care very deeply about human rights. And I think there's certainly space politically to make an appeal to young people about free trade along those lines.
Right. And the ways in which free trade often brings a freer press as well, and the role that the press can play for transparency in countries such as yes. China. Is that a fair assessment, Meg, that free trade generally brings freer press access to?
It can, depending on the way it's negotiated. I think you have more options when it's a smaller group, I'd say, than one of these massive international organizations and some trade deals there. But when you have one-on-one or just a couple small groups, they really can, you know, push for some of these bigger reforms that are in the best interest and tend to be in the best interest of the trade and economics situations of all sure. parties involved.
This is certainly one of the lessons from the Cold War. We're in a different geopolitical context now, but during the Cold War, the Soviet desire for Western goods and Western capital in the 1970s was definitely one of the motivations for the Soviet Union agreeing to sign what became known as the Helsinki Final Act of 1975 that allowed for much more transparency around human rights issues in the Soviet bloc. So there is some precedent for that, but I think your point, Meg, is this has to be negotiated in a strategic way, which is all the more reason why blanket tariffs are dangerous. So I think we've covered so much here. I want to thank you, Meg Rees, for joining us, for sharing your insights on free trade, on tariffs, on the nature of international trade negotiations. And I want to remind our listeners to take a look at the important work your company is doing around AI and international issues. Meg's company is called Solid Intel, and I imagine that you'll all hear more about her company in the coming years. Zachary, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your poem, as always, with our podcast listeners and your wonderful questions. And thank you most of all to our loyal listeners and loyal subscribers to our Substack newsletter for joining us for this episode of This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio
and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Harris Codini.
Stay tuned for a new episode every week.
You can find This Is Democracy on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
See you next time.